Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and on this week's show, we're taking a look at an issue that kicked up this week when creepware scumbags FlexiSpy announced they were moving their bug bounty program to HackerOne. Vice journalist Joseph Cox asked HackerOne CEO Martin Mikos if he'd be happy to host that program. And here's his answer, and I quote, "Any company that operates legally within its jurisdiction, treats our hackers with respect, and takes vulnerability disclosure seriously is generally welcome to run their program on the HackerOne platform. Improving the integrity of all connected software is to the benefit of the digital society." Now, a lot of people, myself included, had a pretty hostile reaction to that line of thinking, it must be said. And I gave them a pretty hard time on the old Twitters, as many did, to the point where HackerOne CTO Alex Rice suggested he come on the show to talk about it. And as you'll hear, Alex is pushing a softer line than his chief executive, but still says this is complicated. So stay tuned for that, at times, excruciating interview. It is coming up later. This week's sponsor interview is a real winner. Now, you'll notice I never say a sponsor interview is bad, because you kind of can't do that to your sponsors, and they can be sometimes, right? But you'll also notice I don't always say they're good, but I'm happy to say this one is a good interview. Zane was the head of security at Etsy, but he moved on from there to found Signal Sciences. He's the co-founder of Signal Sciences, a company that is making web app security software that, by all reports, is pretty damn good. He joins us in the sponsor slot this week to talk about DevOps, WAFs, and a whole bunch of other fun stuff. And yeah, it's just an interesting conversation with someone who really knows what they're talking about when it comes to running web apps in a fast-paced environment. He talks about how WAFs basically aren't cutting it anymore, and about some new approaches they've devised that help security teams managing web apps to keep things mostly under control. As I say, that's a fun and interesting segment, and not an interview you should miss. We'll get into all of that in a bit, but first up, it's time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, there is apparently a comet heading towards Earth, and its name is, well, it doesn't actually have a name, which is nice, but it's this terrible bunch of Intel bugs that have made so many people arm flappy. Is the arm flappiness justified?
Well, it's kind of hard to say. So potentially, like, if this bug was as bad as it could be, then yes, the arm flap, like, it would be just catastrophic. Like, it would be a planet melter. It doesn't actually seem to be that bad, but we are still kind of struggling. So the story here is that there is a bug in Intel's like onboard management engine, which is kind of part of the Northbridge of modern Intel CPUs, primarily for enterprise use. They have a couple of acronyms. AMT is the Intel Active Management Technology, but there's a bunch of other variants of it as well. But essentially, it's the thing that is the difference between Intel parts that have the vPro designation and those that don't. It provides remote management of systems that enterprise people can use to, you know, reboot their machines or patch them or whatever. And amongst, you know, think of it like a, you know, a KVM or a remote console or a lights out management system. Anyway, there is a bug apparently that allows, it sounds like auth bypass remotely to the web services ports of the AMT component. And, you know, were that the case on every Intel machine manufactured since 2003, which is one of the kind of the claims being made, then it would be really, really, really bad. And it's not. It doesn't appear. So the actual technology is only enabled on some classes of Intel CPUs, and then it has to be kind of turned on. And I don't believe it's on by default. Shodan scans for the relevant ports, because apparently the AMT component will actually, like, hijack individual a pair of TCP ports from the host network stack. So regardless of your local firewalling, whatever, it can get out onto the internet. Which
that
is,
that sounds entirely sensible.
Which is, yeah, exactly right. What an awful idea.
I always want an embedded web server running, you know, in my chipset, because that's just a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, it really is one of those things that is an awful idea. You can see why enterprises do it for remote management, but yeah, anyway, but yeah, it needs to be perfect. It's one of those things that absolutely has to be perfect the whole time.
Look, I am often surprised, right? Because I'll say something on the show like, why would anyone use this? And then I'll get a whole bunch of email from about a million people saying, everyone uses this. But is this something you've seen a lot of, people actually using this to you know, manage their networks with?
So people do use it in enterprise environments. It is an actual thing. I mean, the Shodan scans suggest that there's not that many in the order of thousands on the internet, not tens of thousands that are directly accessible, but clearly people do use it. It's a thing that attackers have been interested in for a while. There was an uptick in Shodan scanning a few months ago on these ports, so clearly some people were interested.
The InfoSec equivalent of insider trading, basically, right?
Yeah, vulnerability futures. But no, it's we've seen these kinds of bugs in other people's lights out management systems. When we had the Supermicro ones a while back, the Dell ones have had some issues, the HP ones have had some issues. This is not an unusual class of bug. It's just that Intel is in a very unique position in that, you know, every machine shipped, you know, other than what AMD has been doing, you know, probably has at least some of this stuff in it. I mean, my laptop, for example, has the necessary components. I turned it off in the BIOS when I set my machine up because I'm not psychotic. But it is a thing that is in wild use and on internal networks, you know, where it was turned on, where it is available for management, then, you know, this might be absolutely catastrophic. Although, on the other hand, if you're on the inside of a corporate network, you're probably already in the absolutely catastrophic phase.
Yeah, but this is like a diamond grade lateral movement exploit. That's pretty bad. Apparently they've patched it. How does one patch these types of firmware bugs? I'm kind of curious about that.
Well, that's the next problem, right? Is patching it involves, you know, kind of some kind of mechanism for providing new firmware up into wherever it stores its guts in the Northbridge, with, you know, some Intel utility for flashing it. But not only do you have to do that, which I imagine is A, intrusive, B, error prone, C, if it goes wrong, you're going to brick your machine. You've also got to deal with all of the kind of OEM aspects of it. Like, it's one thing for Intel to issue a patch, but then you've got to get those patches from your upstream OEM, you know, your HPs or your Dells or whoever. And in the case of the big vendors like HP or Dell or Lenovo, we are seeing them show up with patches. Lenovo have put out an advisory which lists, you know, kind of per product, what the correct version should be and when they're going to have patches available, that kind of thing. But if you're running some no-name white box fleet of machines, you're basically screwed.
Yeah.
And that will be for, you know, a bulk of machines that remain vulnerable for the rest of time. That will just be the state they're going to be. Like, there's just never going to be a patch from, you know, some cheap no-name vendor that you might have bought in a white box server solution or something that's, you know, around the back of your network. And if you're a big hosting provider that buys that kind of white box stuff to save money, then you're probably just straight up screwed.
Well, I mean, you know, look, if you're a hosting company, those ports are going to be firewalled off. You would hope and pray, right? That's a pretty easy fix. But, you know, on the LAN side, it's, you know, it's pretty gnarly. So you're saying these things need to be turned on? I mean, are those ports accessible by default on any hardware?
So no, they're not turned on by default. I mean, in an enterprise environment where you are using this, you would turn this on and then they would be available everywhere. So by default,
Can you then update via this mechanism which the floor exists, or do you need to actually go around physically and touch every computer?
I mean, you'll be able to do the update from the OS, and you could bootstrap it through this mechanism were you particularly masochistic. I mean, one of the features of this is, for example, you can boot off an ISO image that you've made accessible via the AMT service. So you can kind of remote reboot the machine, reflash it, reboot it back into its real operating system. So you could do this remotely. It would suck, but it's kind of what this is for. The other aspect that we haven't really talked about is there is a corresponding Windows OS service which interacts with this to allow you to kind of communicate with it from the operating system. And there appears to be a second bug which may let you turn it on or, you know, configure it without permissions locally. So there's also an option for a local privilege escalation vector where someone who's on a box could turn on this thing and then use that to compromise the machine. The third aspect that is, I think, interesting about this is it does give you a bunch of, you know, it's essentially physical access, and physical access to a machine, you know, wins by design. So being able to do things like bypass disk crypto by virtue of being able to kind of modify the boot up process of the machine or like do all those kind of pre-boot attacks is an interesting vector for someone to use this for, you know, for nefarious purposes in a way that we, you know, other bugs might not be quite so straightforward to do. There's also the discussion that you could, if the bug turns out to be, because we don't really know the details of the bug here, which is the other problem. If the bug turned out to be code exec rather than just kind of unauthorized access, then we're in a different, you know, a whole other different game because this processor has DMA access to the rest of the machine and like you're into full on, you know, snare territory there where, yeah, you know,
that's really not where you want to be, by the way, listeners.
you don't want to be snared. No, that's
no, crazy. No. So this is a pretty horrible mess, and the true extent of, you know, how bad it is, we just don't know.
No, and I think the real thing we have to take away from this is that, you know, that Intel monoculture is a big issue for us as an industry, and someone like Intel just, you know, really has to be perfect in this kind of embedded stuff. Like, you really can't YOLO it in the same way that you can get away with if you're a Supermicro or something where you're just not going to melt the whole planet.
They're a hardware company, so their development cycles are like 20 years. You know what I mean? So I'm just amazed that they're dabbling with this sort of stuff at all.
Yeah, it just seems like a bad idea. It's not a thing that you want, right? I mean, leave it to the, you know, the server vendors, the OEMs, like HP and Dell and Lenovo, whoever, to kind of add this stuff, because presumably they'll, you know, expend more effort, although that's, of course, not borne out at all.
Well, I don't know, man. It just means that when they screw up, they're only affecting their own customers instead of, you know, every machine on the planet, right?
It's just bad. Like, and we are lucky that it is not as bad as it could be. And if it really was the worst, like, I just, Emma, what would you even do if this was as bad as it could be, you know?
Well, I guess, you know, we'll keep everyone posted with updates as they come in on that one. But look, a big news story over the last week has been that someone apparently breached a post-production, television post-production company and stole the latest season of the Netflix show Orange is the New Black. And they tried to ransom it to Netflix, who said, yeah, do your worst. And sure enough, it popped up on the torrents. I got to say, though, I can't imagine that this is going to cost Netflix anything in terms of, you know, users or money, right? I can't see that this is actually going to have much of an impact on them.
Well, yeah, I kind of agree with you.
Because people who are going to pirate the stuff are going to pirate it anyway, right? And if you're an Orange is the New Black fan, you're probably a subscriber already, and you're not just going to cancel your subscription to pirate it early because, do you know what I mean? You're already paying for the platform. Like, it's just one of those things where you just sort of think, well, so what?
Exactly. Agree completely. I mean, I think if it was something else, like a film, and there's some suggestion that the people who've owned Larson Studios have compromised a bunch of other pre-released content, those might be more sensitive. And perhaps that's the angle here, you know, drop something that really they had no expectation of getting blackmail money out of, so that then the people that they're really going to blackmail, like, I don't know what film it is that they made. Apparently they got, 36 television series in one film, according to the story in Ars. Maybe this is the we're serious demonstration for the other people they're actually trying to blackmail.
Because this is the missile test.
Except goes more, except that it's gone better than the North Korean ones, where the the Americans seem to have made a blow up again. I don't know what's up with that.
But yeah, look, I mean, if you were going to shake some bitcoins out of these people, this would be a good way to go about it. So I think you might be right.
Yeah, although I think the reports are so far that no one appears to have actually paid the Bitcoin address that they're requesting payment to. So no success yet.
Ah, now, Adam, there is this wormy fishy thing. You called it a wormy fishy thing when we spoke about it earlier, because it's like, you know, great definition there, actually, because it is.
Super technical terminology.
Super technical terminology. But there's like this Google Docs thing going around that's actually hosing an awful lot of Google accounts and picking up a lot of press in the meantime. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this is a fish that kind of sets up a page that requests like OAuth, like app authentication to your Google account, and it looks like a real Google authorizing thing to access your account page, and then the net result is it gives the attacker access to your Gmail inbox and contact lists and things like that, and then it propagates itself through your contacts. So yeah, that's the kind of the wormy aspect, sort of the OAuth fishy aspect is.
It's dressed up to look like a click here to edit this Google document. So I might get one of these that purports to come from you saying, hey, you know, and it's that typical invitation to edit Google Docs thing, which is why I think a lot of people are falling for it.
Yeah, I mean, it does look pretty legit. And then it was hitting the button you got in your email, or the link you got in your email, redirected you off to a bunch of kind of Google-esque sounding phishing domains that then presented a good looking facsimile of the Google Docs, kind of share a document page thing. Google, to their credit, apparently have stomped on the domains that were being used real fast. So clearly they are across the progress of this, and a bunch of people who had their accounts compromised have had that access kind of reverted by Google. So yeah, they're obviously on it.
Yeah, although I did catch a story it didn't make it in the news list, but apparently some of these Russian crews are starting to use like OAuth jacking to compromise targets as well. Like, this is kind of the new cool, which is you just get someone to enable access and, you know, you get an OAuth token and hey, you've owned them, right?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly makes an interesting way to get access that doesn't you know, people have less of an understanding how that kind of federated auth works. So it's less obviously suspicious than the kind of more password focused phishing. And yeah, we did see this being used by what was the unfortunately named Pornstorm campaign that Trend Micro reported on, which is nominally attributed to the Russian intelligence using this kind of approach a while ago.
Yeah, well, apparently it might be going around in France at the moment, right? So that's big surprises
well,
there.
That would make sense, yes.
Yeah. Facebook has just hired a whole stack of people, like thousands of people apparently, to do content moderation, and they're really taking on this this idea of trying to combat disinformation being spread on their platform. And to be honest, I just don't know how that's going to go. You know, the obvious problem being that when you start flagging content and removing it, people scream censorship.
Well, yeah, and then you also kind of start taking responsibility for the content on your platform, which I guess Facebook probably doesn't want to do given how much and how bad it is. But yeah, it's an interesting – I mean, I guess they have to do something, and maybe that's – like doing something at all is the important thing, lest they have something worse foisted upon them, because, I mean, there's been some, you know, sort of political motivation to – you know, stomp on the whole quote fake news unquote thing. But yeah, it's an interesting story. I mean, Facebook have put out this paper called Information Operations in Facebook, written amongst other people by Alex Stamos, which kind of describes their understanding of PsyOps on the Facebook platform and what they've seen of it. And it's an interesting, well, I guess it's an interesting sort of sign of the times that, you know, a social network has to, you know, deal with, you know, military grade PsyOps on their platform as a thing. But I don't know where this leads, eh?
Yeah, look, as you say, a sign of the times. But I think it's good that Facebook has acknowledged that it has a problem in that it is being, you know, targeted in this way. So, you know, we'll see what their approach looks like. We'll see how well it scales. We'll see if David Avocado Wolf winds up being kicked off the network. These are the things we will look forward to finding out, Adam. Now, staying with, you know, some weird state-sponsored stuff, apparently there's been a couple of interesting little things happening with routing protocols lately. I'm thinking specifically of BGP and SS7. The first one is a Russian-controlled telco apparently hijacked a whole bunch of financial services companies' internet traffic, which is like, yeah, a little bit sus.
Yeah, really, really, really is. There was a five to seven minute hijack of 36 different net blocks belonging almost exclusively to, you know, interesting financial organizations. Or yeah, there's sort of a strange mix of people, you know, Visa and MasterCard and HSBC Bank, UBS Bank. Like, yeah, interesting list for about 7 or 8 minutes, went off through in the middle of Ross Telecom for a little while, and then magically came back again. This kind of BGP hijacking is pretty well recorded now. There's enough people running telemetry on the global BGP, you know, announcements that we do get good data about these things, much more than we would have done, you know, 10 years ago.
But recording it, it's all very well and good, but it doesn't stop it actually happening, does it? You know,
well, no, it really doesn't. And you got to wonder, like, you know, some of the articles reporting on this have gone, well, you know, everything's encrypted these days, all the transactions are encrypted, it doesn't buy you anything. Like, clearly those people don't actually know how things get hacked, because I'm wondering how many passwords got reset via email during that 7 minute window. Because yeah, doesn't take long and you're only one set of creds. And yeah, I would be interested to know exactly where that led.
It's an interesting little window. Speaking of, you know, redirecting stuff via, you know, shady old protocols that don't really work very well. SS7, apparently someone's been doing a whole bunch of attacks against two-factor auth enabled bank accounts. And, you know, we've been waiting for this to happen en masse for quite some time, and it does appear to be ramping up. People have been using SS7 attacks to compromise bank accounts protected with SMS two-factor. So it's here.
Yeah, it is interesting seeing this actually being done against live banks. The Germans seem.
I mean, we've seen phone porting before, but I don't think that we've seen this, you know, SS7 used in this way before, like at scale, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen it used for tracking, like the SS7 access to HLR tracking to figure out where people are. We've seen that being used criminally before, but we've seen it being used for, you know, party tricks and proving, you know, proofs of concept. But yeah, actually seeing, you know, significant amount of money being stolen from banks through two-factor auth hijack via SMS via SS7, that is, it's a new twist, and clearly it's a thing that we're going to have to deal with.
Yeah, that's right. WikiLeaks dropped some more stuff. Most recently, it was a CIA tool called Scribbles, which looks like a sort of less cool version of what Harun Mia and Thinkst came up with in the form of canary tokens, or honey tokens, sorry. Tell us about Scribbles.
Yeah, so this is their like Word document or Microsoft Office document watermarking technique, which uses the same technique as everybody else who's ever been watermarking Word documents is, which is you put a GIF in it, or, you know, a transparent image in it, and wait for the document to trigger a remote load over the internet of that kind of linked image file. That's how everybody's document trackers work. So I'm, you know, I guess I'm not surprised the CIA has one of those. Doesn't seem like particularly groundbreaking information security news from WikiLeaks to me.
Now, the funny thing about this is I've seen people poo-pooing it, like, yeah, as if that works, you know, spies are so much smarter than that. And, like, the truth is they're probably not, right? Like, one or two's probably slipped through the cracks and beaconed back, right? And that would be valuable intel. So, yeah, makes sense that they're doing this. But I'd suggest if you're looking for a more contemporary approach, you might check out Honey Tokens, like what Thinkst has done with Honey Tokens. Oh, you know, we hear about this wire transfer fraud where people pose as CFOs and like send emails to accounts saying, can you please pay these people, you know, $1 million, and the transfer goes through. Apparently, Google and Facebook got scammed to the tune of $100 million in a phishing attack, which is just, you know, unbelievable that organizations like that could lose that amount of money. So that's an interesting yarn. We've linked to that in this week's show notes. And we've got some interesting research here about some potential weaknesses in Microsoft's control flow guard that I thought would, you know, I thought you'd find this one interesting, actually, Adam.
Yeah, the blog post by Endgame Systems about this particular technique called counterfeit object-oriented programming, it's been posted around on our work IRC a few times over the last week or two. But it's a write-up of what was originally an academic technique called counterfeit object-oriented programming, which is a mechanism for, you know, gaining control flow without using the sorts of exploitation primitives, you know, like return-oriented programming, that the current generation of exploit, generic exploit mitigation, like Control Flow Guard from Microsoft and some of the, you know, others from other OS vendors and various other people who are interested in this sort of thing. Endgame Systems being one company that does make, you know, this sort of mitigation technology. Anyway, they wrote up this technique, which essentially involves kind of creating fake objects in memory and finding a piece of code that iterates through those objects, calling a function on them, and using that as a programming primitive during exploitation, which kind of bypasses the current control flow, you know, hijack detection techniques, because it's just a completely kind of left field technique. But yeah, really interesting one. If you're into fancy exploit dev,
fancy
it's
exploits.
Certainly worth. Yeah, fancy exploits.
Caviar grade exploits. Champagne ownage.
Mahogany.
Rich mahogany. apparently someone demoed, you know, a hack against a robotic arm, which made for some great stunt hacking, and everyone's going woo about that one. Yeah, so that's like, one you can
such rubbish stunt hacking. It's just another Internet of Things. It just happens to be a big orange robot.
That's right. NIST has released some new password guidelines, which has softened the requirements for length and complexity, which I guess in this age of enhanced 2FA authentication is kind of to be expected. So that's interesting as well. Now, we've spoken a couple of times about BrickaBot, which is this, you know, IoT worm that goes around bricking like vulnerable devices. But apparently there's another vigilante botnet called Hajime, which is apparently pretty, like, right on. Like, someone put a lot of work into this one.
Yeah, it seems to be quite sophisticated. It uses trackerless BitTorrent, so like distributed hashtag BitTorrent for command and control and for distributing like updates to itself. And it has a much more sophisticated kind of brute force mechanism. You know, for example, it kind of fingerprints the device it's connecting to before it decides what passwords it's going to throw out. So a bunch of kind of, you know, relatively, well, I guess a bunch of work went into it, and yeah, well engineered.
It feels like, you know, Stephen Ridley's weekend project sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? Maybe, like, yeah. It's a marketing botnet campaign done right for IoT. Yeah. So yeah, apparently, you know, when we delve into a bit more detail on this thing, you know, whoever's put it together has put messages on the devices saying, hey, I'm just a white hat cleaning up devices. Apparently it's taking over from Mirai-controlled devices and locking out Mirai access and whatever, but we'll see. It's probably just someone building another botnet that they can DOS people with for Bitcoin. So let's see if the vigilante tag actually sticks. meanwhile, Andy Greenberg's written this up for Wired, which is kind of a silly headline, actually, calling it an obscure app flaw, creating a backdoor in millions of smartphones. When you read what that flaw actually is, it just means that some apps are opening ports on on smartphones to allow you to do stuff like on your LAN, you know what I mean? So when you're at home on your Wi-Fi, your laptop can communicate with the thing. But the way that's being implemented is quite often without auth and allows you to do all sorts of things to the device that you shouldn't be able to do. So it's kind of like the extent of this as a problem is a little bit surprising, I've got to say.
Yeah, I guess we know we've sort of gone a long way from the implementation of our systems when we have to put port in scare quotes in news articles.
Yeah, it's funny to see that making a comeback. But yeah, it opens a port. Quote unquote.
I didn't say port in scare quotes. Yeah, it's, I mean, I guess the interesting bit here is that they undertook analysis of apps that are in the Google Play Store to try and determine how many of them actually run network listening services of their own, and then reviewed those for ones that have, you know, no auth or rubbish auth or obvious bugs. And sure enough, some of them, you know, for example, provide file transfer off your device with no auth, which is bad, clearly, especially if you're on a, if it is also accessible on the cellular interface and your carrier, you know, gives you a public IP and that kind of thing. Those would be bad things. And there are some apps that do that. But yeah, I'm surprised actually at how few apps in the app stores open network listening ports and are rubbish.
I guess you know, like I gotta stop being surprised by people doing stupid things, so you know what I mean. But I do remember seeing a talk at RuxCon years ago, I think it was Finbar Davies actually, who you know, looked at the default open ports on a bunch of smartphones, I think iOS and Android at the time, and one of the major telcos here in Australia was actually assigning real-world IPv4 addresses to every single smartphone on its network. I don't think they do anymore, but that was like, oof, better hope there's not a problem in, you know, on one of those services, but there you go. Apple has apparently nuked a bit of malware by using its X-Protect built-in anti-malware, whatever. They revoked a certificate and nuked it that way, but there seems to be more and more innovation in the Apple malware space, so there's that. IBM has destroyed a bunch of USB sticks that were infected with a malware dropper that they were distributing. Were they distributing them to clients, or was it booth swag, or what was this?
This was a USB stick that came with some particular IBM, I think, storage appliances, and it had the kind of like initial setup thing that you ran.
Great.
And so, yeah, you plugged into your machine and got owned. So, yeah, that's not a particularly good look.
Well done, IBM. Google's patched 6 bugs in Media Server. Been a while. It's been like a couple of months since we've seen some of them.
Yeah, and we haven't seen a stage fright bug in a little bit. But, yeah, they patched a bunch of those. There's also some other bugs in the various hardware drivers and things. All the usual blame assigned to Qualcomm on that half. But, yeah, so patch your Androids as usual.
And before we go, Adam, we got to spend a couple of minutes talking about a new device. A new device, which is very, very exciting. It's called Nomex. And, you know, it's a secure way to host your own email server, because all of these other major mail providers keep getting owned, accounts keep getting compromised. Now you can buy a $200 device from this company called Nomex, and all of your problems are solved. But unfortunately not. there's this teardown by a guy called Scott Helm. Is just hilarious. He's taken this device that promises the world, says everything else is insecure, this is the world's most impenetrable email device, and it's just hilarious. It's hilarious.
It is. It's just, it's everything as bad as you would expect. You know, it's a Raspberry Pi running bog standard
Everything's
Linux.
Worse. I mean, it's amazing. Their idea of sending email securely is to just, between Nomex devices, they send email on port 26. Like, that's their thing. Do you know what I mean? It's just, it's wild.
And it doesn't work, like, when you've changed IP address, because it has to update the DIN DNS. But they don't use a DIN DNS provider. They use like GoDaddy API
They use GoDaddy API keys as DIN DNS. I mean, it's
with a high TTL. Oh, and it's, man. Everything about it is absolutely awful.
And but it's like, it's almost like it was invented for comedic effect. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's so awful that it's awesome.
I mean, I guess it reminds us how far we've come with snake oil in the industry. I mean, the quality of snake oil that you get these days is pretty good, but it's nothing like this. I mean, this really is. I haven't seen something this bad in quite a long time. Like, it's exactly what you'd expect, where you've got one guy who doesn't understand how the world works and doesn't understand threat modeling and doesn't understand how things actually happen, and then he's paid his neighbor's kid to build him a box, and then is making all these ridiculous claims about it. And it's just, you know, it's embarrassing, obviously, for InfoSec in general. But yeah, a comedy read if you do want some cheap laughs.
I mean, the best part is probably right up the top when he cracks the box. Do you know what I mean? It's like this little box. And inside it is a Raspberry Pi, like taking up a quarter of the footprint of the box. I mean, it's just, yeah. Like, and it's running like 4-year-old versions of Nginx. And it's just like, you've got to read this. And it's done the rounds on Twitter. You know, if you haven't heard about it, please go to the show notes and just, you know, Have a look for Nomex because it's very funny. Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us as always, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Cheers, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Okay, it is time to get into this week's feature topic now. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, bug bounty provider HackerOne's statement that it would allow creepware developer FlexiSpy to host a bug bounty on its platform certainly stirred a few people up, myself included. And obviously, that's my, you know, that's what I inferred from their statement, that they would allow it. Now, at this point, I have to declare my conflict when talking about HackerOne here. Its primary competitor is BugCrowd, which is a sponsor of this podcast. And in addition to that, BugCrowd's CEO, Casey Ellis, is actually a pretty good friend of mine. We're good friends. So, you know, I'm just mentioning that as to be transparent here. Now, look, I guess I'll also set some personal context here. I won't even do business with some major AV and security companies because I don't think their products are very good. So for me, the idea that someone would willingly engage with a company like FlexiSpy is just very, very strange. It's so far outside of the bounds of what I consider personally acceptable for me. After all, their products are marketed explicitly as a way for people to spy on their partners, as Amnesty International technologist and Citizen Lab research fellow Claudio Guarnieri explained to me.
Before the breach and before they started getting publicity, there were, you know, advertisements all over the place saying, you need to know the truth. You can spy on your wife and see if she's cheating or something like that. And a lot of that has been removed. But it remains the entirety of their community forum where people discuss about how they're using these types of things. And that's a great indication because you'll see a lot of people discussing about their cheating wives and husbands. And there's FlexiSpy staff there answering them, both like, empathizing with them, but also providing support and answers to their questions on using those things specifically for that purpose. So it's not really a secret or anything that they were hiding at all. They have an entire section of personal stories and relationships where people share, you know, their experiences, both in terms of how they've been using the tool, but also like in deep details about what's been going on in their relationships and things. It's pretty out in the open there. Generally speaking, with the conversations online that we've been having, I wholeheartedly disagree with the premise that there are some legitimate uses, and therefore it is kind of more morally imperative to make these products safer for these people to use. Firstly, we're talking in specific about one company, and one company particularly that has been, as we said, kind of aggressively targeting an extremely abusive market. If it would have been the case of a different company, of a competitor that has been kind of stayed out of that entire line of argument, then probably things would be a lot different. But for this case,
I mean, a lot of it is in the messaging, isn't it? I mean, if it was purely a website targeted towards parental controls and the whole business messaging was around that, it might not feel so icky.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. And instead, we have a company that, for example, runs a website. It's called Catch a Cheating Spouse, and gives you solutions and indications of why you should use these kind of tools to monitor your spouse because you feel suspicious of them. So they've been clearly infiltrating this kind of market and this kind of area of domestic abuses, and that's extremely problematic. And secondly, kind of the argument that, you know, still a safer kind of invasive tool and abusive tool is better than an unsafe one, it kind of falls short. I mean, then what are we going to do? Are we going to have bug bounties for, crypto lockers as well? Because, you know, it's safe for people to have their files encrypted appropriately. I'm not sure. Like, this seems a bit of a stretch.
So yeah, FlexiSpy isn't making some sort of parental control package that makes its presence known on the device. They are marketing to the worst instincts of jealous people and enabling surveillance that clearly, at least to me, meets the definition of domestic abuse. Before we continue, we should note that FlexiSpy hasn't actually launched this bug bounty program yet, just to be clear. That has not happened. So now let's get the other view. HackerOne CTO Alex Rice joined me via Skype, bravely, I might add, to talk about this. He agrees that FlexiSpy is, you know, by all intents and purposes, an awful company, but says it's not necessarily up to companies like HackerOne to be the morality police. Here's what he had to say.
We very fundamentally believe that vulnerability disclosure is a critical part of making technology secure. We've been on a mission for a while now to try to get every organization to have some type of open dialogue with the security community, a way for vulnerabilities to get reported. And it's we've come a long way from the default being hackers getting cease and desist letters and jail sentences to at least most organizations, the norm being having disclosure policies. And so up until last week, the mere thought that HackerOne would disable an organization's security at was pretty unthinkable. But there's been a lot of good arguments on both sides as to why that policy should be examined.
Well, I mean, you know, no one would suggest that you would disable their security at, you know, perhaps maybe you just wouldn't run it for them.
Well, right. That's actually why this turns into a bit of a philosophical debate, is we don't have a process in place by which to decide if we would host it or not, right? As long as you have control of an email address, you could point it to the platform. And so we need to have a bit of a longer discussion on, should we pre-approve every vulnerability disclosure program that launches on the platform? And there may be some cost to that. You also made a good point there about whether or not we would do it in the first place. And one of the other discussions that we're having is, should we draw a distinction between a vulnerability disclosure program and a bug bounty program? And a lot of the arguments against FlexiSpy having a program of this nature really focus a lot of the discussion around the bounties rather than just should they have a security at email.
Yeah, but I mean, they can do that without you, right? I think where people were getting concerned is that you were essentially looking at doing business with a company that, you know, depending on who you talk to, can more or less be regarded as a criminal enterprise. I mean, you know, we've seen people being sentenced to prison time for creating hacker tools that they never used personally to penetrate a target with, right? So, I mean, these companies that make this creepware, they're operating in very legally sketchy territory, almost certainly breaking laws in a bunch of countries. So why would you put yourself in a position where you're doing business with them, particularly given the, you know, super creepy nature, not only of the product, but the way that it's marketed? Like, this stuff was well and truly marketed towards paranoid partners.
It's a really good question of where do we draw the line for who we will or won't allow on the platform. And one of our strongest arguments for it is that humanity doesn't have a great track record on companies and the court of public opinion casting judgment on this. And we're not implementing it consistently across the technology sector here. What I mean by that is they're currently running a bug bounty program today using a combination of Google for their email and PayPal for their accounts. And we get into a pretty uncomfortable legal area if we are inconsistently deciding who should we shut down email for, which PayPal account should we freeze, or which bounty program should we shut down. And so we've defaulted to not being the judge in those situations. But as you just mentioned, there's very, very good arguments for why perhaps we should. What additional benefits does FlexiSpy get for hosting on HackerOne rather than hosting themselves? And
well, it's easier. They get the marketing benefit. They get to say that it's securely tested. I mean, a whole bunch of things, right? Like, I understand that setting the line, right? Finding the line between, you know, whether or not you want to do business with someone, like, based on how shady they are. Maybe you are going to do business with a company like, say, Uber, right? Which has a track record of not respecting the local laws in a whole bunch of jurisdiction where it operates, right? So that might be a nuanced conversation you're going to have. Do you want to do a bug bounty program for the Pentagon or the CIA or, you know, a whole bunch of institutions that have done, you know, some pretty sketchy stuff, right? So I understand that there are nuanced arguments to be had about who you're going to host bounties for, but this is not one of those times. This is so far from being nuanced. Like, why is this even a discussion? Isn't this so clearly over the line that you would just not do it?
It's hard to say. And
but
particularly
is it?
When you
really?
No. Because you say it that way, in that, from my personal perspective on where they're at, they're absolutely over the line. there is nothing ethical or moral about how this organization is behaving. It's unbelievable that this what they're doing isn't clearly illegal, or that law enforcement isn't already taking action on them. And it's not so much a question of are they over the line based on an individual's opinion. And from my perspective, they absolutely are. It's a question of where do we enforce that, and what are the right angles to make that decision. And when
I believe your competitor Casey Ellis of Bug Crowd said that if they'd asked him to host a bounty program on his platform, he'd tell them to die in a fire. I would have thought that's a pretty easy, I mean, it's not the most policy oriented reaction, but I'm just sort of curious as to why this is the place to have that argument. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm just wondering, what is it about this situation where you can't just categorically say no, they can piss off and, you know, do it themselves?
I think that's the debate that we're having, and the very good feedback that we've received from the community has caused us to examine these policies. In other cases, organizations are set up where they have an existing pre-approval process. As it stood on HackerOne, we hadn't. And this discussion has gotten us to the point where we are having very vigorous debates internally on should we approve every program that launches on the platform. And I think there's some very strong arguments towards yes. The strongest, I believe, one that you referred to just a second ago, which is there is very real benefit to organizations being able to claim that they are certified by HackerOne or tested by HackerOne in this way that FlexusPy doesn't have access to independently. And that is probably one of the best arguments for there is something different about running your program, running a vulnerability disclosure program on HackerOne versus somewhere else. And maybe that means it needs to have a disclosure process.
Well, the fact that they'd be paying you money indicates that there would be a benefit, because they wouldn't pay you money if there was no benefit. You know, I mean, but, you know, essentially what we're talking about here is a company that makes malware, right, which enables, you know, a form of domestic abuse, which is spying on a partner. If you go indeed to their community forum, you will see post after post about people spying on their partners. You know, maybe one post in the community forum about someone using for monitoring.
We're in agreement. It is a horrible software. It is a horrible business. People are being victimized.
So why would you become a part of their world? Like, why would you take a check with their name on it? You know, I just sort of don't get why this is a conversation. I think it's great that you guys are moving along to having a conversation about this internally, but I just can't understand why there wasn't a snap reaction, which along the lines of those guys.
So on the check comment, the default offering on HackerOne is a free vulnerability disclosure service. You don't pay us anything to sign up and host your program on HackerOne, which is why there's no approval process for doing it. It's the same amount of friction as signing up for a Gmail account. The second point is vulns in spyware that is deployed in this manner are universally bad for everybody. If there is a vulnerability that gives a hacktivist access to FlexusPy's customer/victim database, do I want to see that vulnerability resolved rather than left open or exploited?
But doesn't that increase the likelihood that the victim of this spying is going to find out that it's happening to them? I would have thought that that's actually a positive thing, because they're most at risk. They're more at risk from the person living under the same roof as them who is controlling their every move than they are from some, you know, some Jake Davis version 2.0 who's going to put their docs on the internet. You know what I mean? Like that might be a positive thing.
It could be. It's hard to say. I think in general, though, it's very difficult to predict the full implications of what a complete doxing of their customer base would look like, and what downstream or negative effects would that have. And so when we get into those conversations around should we leave this vulnerability open or should we close this vulnerability and notify the company about it, historically, we've fallen on the side of these vulnerabilities can have implications that we can't possibly predict. And it's an uncomfortable conversation to draw where we leave vulnerabilities open and where we close them. Our default stance is let's close them.
So what about a dark web marketplace that sells drugs? I mean, they have run their own Bitcoin bounties. Would you be happy to host them?
Oh, someone that's selling illegal, illicit drugs would, no, they wouldn't be hosted on HackerOne under our current policies.
Okay. And what about like the makers of other malware like Drydex?
Also very clearly illegal. And that's,
isn't this also very clearly illegal?
they're making a case that it's not. And that's, well, I think that's completely wrong. And this is, there seems to be used in ways where it is, as you were saying, breaking the law in many different jurisdictions out there. Where we come down on is wanting to pause and wanting to get someone else to draw the, to make the judgment of whether or not it's illegal or not. And so part of our activities over the past week has been having as many conversations as we can with other legal counsel, with the EFF, with our local law enforcement to try to understand, is this actually illegal?
And but even if it's not illegal, you would have to agree that it's harmful, Alex. I mean, you know... Wouldn't you?
No, I do agree that it's.
Regardless of whether it's illegal or not, can't you then make a moral judgment and say we don't want to be a part of this and we're not going to enable this?
Are we really enabling it? You're deriving
a benefit from it. Do you know what I mean? You have already said that they would derive a benefit from it. Do you really want to be enabling a benefit to an organization like this?
That's the part I'm not sure about. I don't want them to have extra benefit from HackerOne, and I want to find a way where they're not benefiting from these programs or any supplemental benefit that they have. And if it's clear that we cannot find a way to structure this where they don't get additional benefit from hosting their program with us, then it very much changes the tone of the conversation. But giving them additional benefit versus our policies to date, which have been structured around, do we allow them to receive vulnerabilities from the community, has been, those haven't been separate from each other. And what this debate has caused us to do is to have a conversation on whether or not those should be separate practices. Because as it stands today, we haven't been able to separate those two out. Either we don't allow vulnerabilities to be reported to the organization, or there's bundled benefit that they get out of it. And I think we have to actually be able to find a way to separate those two out, whether that ends up being bounty programs have a different approval process from vulnerability disclosure programs, or there are additional advertising constraints on it.
So they are running a vulnerability disclosure program on your platform, not a bounty program, but a vulnerability disclosure program.
Not today. They're running
not today, right. So there's no connection at the moment.
No connection at the moment. Yeah. They are running a bounty program that they're, and one hacker who was received a payment through it said they were doing it through PayPal, and they talk about it on their Medium post, which is not the most effective way to run one, which is why I assume they talked about moving to a platform. But no one at HackerOne has spoken to anyone at FlexiSpy, which is why this conversation is so a bit funny, and
I think
it more as a bit of a philosophical debate in that we need to have these policies in place before an organization like that reaches out. Because if they had reached out, they would already be up and running without talking to anyone at HackerOne or writing a check to us.
Look, I think the reason this kicked up is because Martin's comments on Twitter just seemed a little out of step with what most people, I guess, in the security industry seem to expect the reaction would be. But Alex, we're going to wrap it up there. But before we go, I just want to say thank you very much for doing this because I think it's fantastic that even though you and I, we both know we disagree with each other, and I think it's fantastic that you have decided to come and do this interview and to talk about a point of difference. That's ballsy, man, and I do appreciate that very much. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Pat. I actually think we agree on more points than we disagree on, which is why I'm very interested in finding out what the right policy for this is going forward. And it's clear our current stance is in need of a pretty thorough review.
Well, we'll wait to see the result of that review. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Pat. Take care.
That was Alex Rice there, and there you go. I think it's pretty clear what I think, but again, I do want to thank Alex Rice for coming onto the show to discuss his point of view. It is a brave man who agrees to argue with the guy who holds the microphone. Okay, on to this week's sponsor segment now, and this week's sponsor slot is a cracker. Zane Lackey has been around InfoSec for a long time now, you know, I guess in InfoSec terms, in that it's a young industry. These days, he serves as the co-founder and chief security officer of Signal Sciences, a VC-backed web application security play. But he's had an interesting career in both offense and defense before Signal Sciences. He worked at ISEC Partners as a security consultant and pen tester for almost 6 years, before moving into a defensive role at Etsy, where he was responsible for the security of its web properties. It was there that he got intimately familiar with development processes and the ins and outs of running complex high-traffic web applications, and all the security challenges that come with that. He also got pretty familiar with how shitty most of the tooling is in the security world. So after a few years in that role, he quit to found or co-found Signal Sciences. Signal Sciences focuses on web application security, but it is not a WAF. It is certainly not a WAF. It's kind of a new approach, actually, to monitoring what's happening with web applications while they're in production. And it's an approach that doesn't suck. When I was at Black Hat last year, Signal Sciences were picking up all sorts of buzz. And the people involved in starting up the business all have great reputations. So yeah, what I'm saying is, if you're an organization that doesn't currently feel comfortable with the monitoring and protections on your web apps, Signal Sciences technology is definitely worth looking at. So do get in contact with them if you want to trial their tech. You can find them at signalsciences.com. So yeah, I spoke to Zane Lackey about the big push to DevOps these days, and about how a development process geared for speed makes quite a lot of security people feel a little bit unsettled, shall we say. And here's what he said. And oh, I should note that I recorded this interview from a hotel room in Sydney using a portable recorder for my part. So the audio quality on my end will be a little bit off. Sorry about that. Here's Zane.
When I sort of landed inside the first DevOps environment that I ever went into, which was in my role as head of security at Etsy, the first time that I really saw that, I had exactly that same security reaction. It's like, wait, you want to do what? How fast? Because that's really the exact opposite of how we've approached security for the last 10, 20 years. And really what I learned through it was that I actually came out the other side really not only drinking the Kool-Aid, but actually kind of dispensing it on, hey, if done right, this shift to DevOps and shift to cloud and just kind of this shift to agility can actually make us safer. And the reality is it's because for the first time we have the actual ability to react against our attackers.
What do you mean by that? Because that's an interesting thing to say. Because yeah. Other people would say, well, we can already react against our attackers.
Totally. I'd say, especially on the application side of things. So if we flash back to 10 years ago and you sit in a kind of waterfall world where, the organization deploys every 18 months, when a critical issue gets discovered, let's take just like a super generic, let's flash back 15 years and say a SQL injection in like the login form of the front page. How the organization can react to that in a waterfall world, the answer is not well. Right, because if you're used to releasing in every 18 months or so, and now you've got to make an emergency release for what's going on, the reality is, at best, that's going to be on the order of weeks to months right there. And the problem is that the organization really just doesn't know how to do it. So what you end up seeing in practice is the organization goes into a panic, tries to release something there, probably breaks about 8 other things along the way, and then slowly tries to fix those over the course of none of your development team or security team or SysOps team there having any sleep over the course of those several weeks.
So there's an advantage to being able to do things quickly if your starting proposition is to use that advantage for the betterment of security.
That's exactly it, right? I think that the real lesson I learned from that side was that every development methodology has vulnerabilities. Why I actually came to really appreciate this movement much faster around DevOps and CI/CD and things like that is for the first time we really have the ability to react, right? You always have bugs. You want the ability to react though as well.
Now, visibility has actually been a bit of an issue mm-hmm. for web apps, right? Because we've always thought of visibility and security as being the network, right?
Yeah.
Let's look at the network, which hasn't really made sense for quite a long time. I mean, it makes sense for some things, but when it comes to websites, it doesn't make sense, right? And there's only so much you've been able to do on the hosts in terms of really getting visibility into what an application's doing. So you had some ideas around getting visibility into live web apps that you kind of put into action at Etsy, and that kind of laid the foundation for what you later did with Signal Sciences, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it, right? I think when you look from, when you kind of follow the data and look at this from an attack perspective, how everyone used to attack infrastructure and kind of network services 15 years ago to get at the data. When you actually look at a modern enterprise or anything like that, if you want to get that data and you want to get it the easiest way, you go attack the web applications. The actual reality on the ground is that everyone's getting owned through the same ways, right? Everyone's getting owned through phishing and moving on the endpoints, or getting popped through the web applications, and then you're laterally moving from either point there.
Now, you're very keen to stress that this is not the gag-worthy idea of a next-generation WAF.
Right. Oh, man.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I actually threw up in my mouth a little bit just saying those words. But, yeah. Not
Tell
a next-generation WAF, right?
Yeah, I'm a vendor now. Tell me about it on throwing up there. I've spent my entire career on the other side of the fence there. And honestly, that's why we really built what we built, is that none of the vendors were providing solutions that actually survived that jump to DevOps and cloud and really giving us visibility and allowing us to move faster. And at a certain point, we got the executive backing to start experimenting there and really start trying to build our own approaches. And so the more that we started talking with our peers and seeing everyone start to really run into the same challenges here, that's what actually led us to building Signal Sciences and actually launching that so that we could help more people there. I mean, at the end of the day, when we thought about it, we were like, look, if we go become CISOs anywhere else, we're still only helping one organization at a time. And so how do we actually try to help the broadest set of people when everyone is going through these shifts? And really the way to do that is was actually become a vendor, which is a crazy thing, I got to say.
So tell us, when it comes to visibility into web apps, like what sort of visibility do you want, right? Because, you know, there's like, we've long had log monitors and things like that. How's this different?
Yeah. So it's funny because the log monitoring bit is actually exactly where everyone starts. It's where we started. It's where everybody starts. The wall that you hit very quickly on the log monitoring side, especially for the web applications, is you realize that you only essentially get data for Git, but all of your application logic actually lives in posts for the most part. But, you know, your post bodies are not going to be logged for a million different reasons in your log. So you realize that when you're starting to do kind of log analysis and everything there, you're only scratching the tiniest bit of the surface. Now, don't get me wrong. It's where everyone starts, and it's for a reason. You can get some results out of it there. But going back to the, you know, what visibility are you actually looking for? It really reminds me of the kind of IDS problems of 20 years ago, where, you know, it's always the classic interview question of, oh, do you put an IDS inside a firewall or outside? Because what are the trade-offs there? You know, it's the same bit has really been applied on the web application side, where the only thing that's existed there are legacy WAFs, and they were just the same sort of big boxes of signatures and everything there as well. And so they didn't give you any usable visibility, because all they could tell you is, oh, somebody, you know, you got 100,000 alerts for different SQL injection attempts.
Yeah, like WAFs, it's long been my opinion that WAFs, like 1 in 100 people who use them actually know what they're useful for. Do you know what I mean? So, like, you know, there's people I know who've got like massive mileage out of some pretty simple WAF tech. But, you know, 99% of people are like, yes, we are cyber protected with our cyber WAF. And you're like, oh, God, you're all going to die.
Yeah, I mean, look at the problem, right? It was most organizations had to buy a WAF for compliance reasons. They didn't even want it in the first place. They had to buy in there. And then you flash forward to today, and they're actually causing more problems than they solve you as an organization, because they're slowing you down. You have to, you know, every time the application releases, you've got to go babysit those rules and delete new false positives and everything there. And they're not actually providing you visibility to enable your teams to move quicker, right? Those are exactly the problems that we lived.
Yeah, you just try to, you know, most of your effort is trying to get them to shut up so that you can go about your business, right? Like,
exactly, right? And not only the additional problem on that side is it's not just you trying to quiet them down as a security team. It's now you're directly impeding the DevOps teams and the development teams' ability to move quicker, which means we're kind of at this existential point on the security side where, just like with the early adoption of cloud, and the reason why all these teams went to cloud was it's short-circuited and routed around these like really arcane and bureaucratic, you know, server ordering processes and everything there, where you needed a server for your application and it would take 8 months of backlog to get it, or you could just put a credit card down and get some instances right away. Security is really at that same existential point where if it tries to keep functioning as this really slow gatekeeper and blocker that doesn't get out of the way and doesn't empower the teams directly, it just gets routed around.
But okay, so take us beyond the logs then, right? So you're saying, okay, we don't, you know, logs are just scratching the surface. So where's the special thing, man? Where's the pitch for your stuff? Like, why would I want it?
So there's kind of a few things here, right? On the visibility side, there's both the breadth and the depth. So the breadth is really around, hey, look, SQL injection and XSS and things like that, they're all really important, but they're never really what kept me up at night as a CISO. What keeps me up at night as a CISO is the broader set of attacks, like the attacks on my sensitive business logic, my risky business functionality there. It's account takeovers against my users. It's application DDoS. It's bots and, you know, automated stuff hitting my site. It's this full breadth of attacks there. And so I really want something that both gives me that breadth, but then I also wanted this visibility into, on the attack side, I want to know not just when attackers are attempting things, I want to know when they're actually successful, right? Don't alert me about the 100,000 SQL injection attempts that somebody throws against me. Alert me when it actually triggers an error in my application, because that's an attacker discovering a real bug, right? And so that's really what we focused on from the visibility side, was how do we give both that depth of coverage and that breadth of coverage? And so that's kind of one side of what we do today from Signal Sciences, is a product that you can just drop in to get that visibility instantly.
So what, that's like a process that you have running on your web servers?
Exactly. Yep. We're just software that you deploy. So we don't care what your technology stack is. We work across any cloud provider that you use, physical infrastructure, containers, platform as a service like Pivotal or Heroku or Bluemix or anything there. We're completely agnostic to the technology choices. It's not some approach where it involves rewriting your application or instrumenting everywhere that you do user input and output and everything there. It's a few lines of code that you drop in at the top of the application if you want to go that route, or a single line if you want to drop it into your Apache config or your Nginx config or IIS config there. So the real focus is on super lightweight deployment. And so much of the value then out of that is around the ability to just scale, right? That it's not some instance you have to go deploy in front of your physical infrastructure or your cloud deployments or anything like that. And you've got to think about single point of failure and scalability and performance and everything like that. We scale really elastically with you, and there's hard guarantees in the architecture around performance and reliability.
So who are your competitors, right? Who else makes software like this?
There's not a ton out there. What we've seen is that we see some of the legacy WAF vendors, because they've been the only thing that's really been in the web application, you know, defense space in the past there. But you know, all of us that have lived through the problems of WAFs, even the organizations that from a compliance reason had to have one, you know, the dirty secret was you always ran it off a spam port and put it in monitor mode and then just shut it in a back room and hope the auditor never saw that. Right, because no one was actually getting any real value out of the things in the first place. So many organizations that we've talked to, they're like, yeah, we, you know, looked at WAFs back in the day because we had to, and either we made a compliance purchase for it and just pushed it away as fast as we could, or we actually didn't purchase anything there because it caused us more problems than we solved. So what we tend to, where we get really excited about helping customers, and where I think we resonate very well, is people that are looking for new ways of defending their applications, and particularly organizations that are embracing DevOps, they're embracing cloud, because they're really looking to, how can we get that good defensive coverage and do it in a way that's not slowing us down and actually empowering the DevOps teams and the development teams directly.
So I'm guessing what you just sort of incorporate this into, the idea is people incorporate this into their standard web server build?
There's kind of two sides there. One is that the actual deployment option, and then the other is how we really plug into the tool chain. So the deployment option is we show up with this menu of choice. So you could drop us into the application itself. You can drop us into the web server itself, like Nginx or IIS or Apache.
Okay, so you're actually generating some code, right, that actually goes into the application.
Yeah, exactly. You can do that route. You can plug into the web server. You could run as a reverse proxy. The real point is we've got this menu of choice so that you as a CISO, as a security lead, you don't have to spend all this political capital showing up to teams and mandating they do it in a certain way. You can bring this menu of deployment choice there to them, and they can select whatever works best for them. And so that's really how you get true broad strategic coverage across an enterprise there, because, you know, if you're an enterprise CISO, you're dealing with a million different technology stacks across your enterprise.
Zane Lackey, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about DevOps and how you guys want to plug into all of that.
Hey, it's great chatting with you. I really enjoyed catching up. It's always a fun time.
That was Signal Sciences Chief Security Officer and co-founder Zane Lackey there with a chat about DevOps, WAFs, their tech, and a bunch of other stuff. You can check them out at signalsciences.com. And as always, if you do contact a Risky Business sponsor because you heard about them on the show, please do tell them that because it does really help us. That's it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.